Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day, the 27th of November, back in 1826. A gentleman by the name of John Walker would accidentally invent something in England. And no, it's not the alcoholic beverage. He would accidentally invent the friction match, what we know today as a match that lights up and sparks a flame. Came across it accidentally in 1826. In 1895, on this day, a separate gentleman by the name of Alfred Nobel would, in his will, establish the Nobel Prize. That's the Swedish chemist, of course. 1960, on this day, the first president of the Ivory Coast would be elected. He would then go on to serve until 1993 for 33 years as the president. In 1962, on this day, the first Boeing 727 jet would roll off the assembly line in Renton, Washington. In 2012, on this day, Greece would receive a 43 billion euro loan from the Eurozone. Loan, bailout, semantics, right? But in 2013, as a result of that financing debacle, Greece would become the first developed economy to be demoted into an emerging market economy by the MSCI index. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we take a look at the latest report by Oxford Economics on the company that, or the state-owned entity rather, that is SAA. They put together a report around the business case for SAA and the impact that SAA has on the economy, on tourism, on the aviation sector, and as a business. We're going to take a look at that report. We're going to see if we can make sense of that report. And most importantly, we're going to see what that means for SAA. Then we've also got a conversation with Alan Gray around the hospitality sector. We're approaching the festive season. We are a couple of days away from December. For some people, December started when Halloween ended, but that's another story for another day. And we're going to take a look at the hospitality sector. It seems that sector's been under pressure for a long time, and some of those stocks haven't yet recovered to their full potential. And we're going to look at what that potential could look like in the weeks and months to come. And then we've also got a conversation with Identify around the concerns as it relates to identity fraud, especially identity theft perpetrated by artificial intelligence, and all these other fantastic things that we now have to deal with in this modern technological era. Then we wrap the show up with a sense of, or rather with an executive lounge segment. We're going to be speaking to the CEO of a JSE listed company known as Lesaka Technologies.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
We kick things off with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by wealth manager at PSG Wealth, Nellis Brink, to take a look at the market movements and see if we can make sense of them. Good evening, Nellis. Lovely to catch up with you. It's been a rather interesting day of movements across the board. Let's start off with some of the movements that were kind of expected. I mean, we anticipated we were going to get a lot of data out of the US today, everything from personal consumption expenditure data to initial jobless claims data and mortgage data, and everything coming in pretty much in line with expectations, and the market's not really responding.
Jimmy, great to be back. It's good to hear that you're doing well. Yes, absolutely. So US data all mostly in line. The numbers that we were looking at specifically was, of course, the consumer confidence number that rose to a 16-month high. And that's usually quite a good indication of where it's heading, where the average American feels their economy is moving towards. And then, of course, the GDP growth slowed slightly, very, very slightly, down to 2.8% in the third quarter. We see a good consumer spending this time of year around Halloween, and then, of course, Black Friday, which seems to be Black Month currently, the way we see the spending going. And then, of course, that will be followed by the Christmas season, which is typically a very good retail spending season as well. We're happy where it's going, and then the Federal Reserve's measurement, or rather their measures that they've applied with the two cuts, the 50 and the 25, seem to be having the desired effect.
We've got another cut expected for December, another 25 basis points on the cards there, but we'll have a conversation about that at another time. I want to look at the overall global sentiment, Nellis. The global equities are a bit of a mixed bag. One day, China and Hong Kong are down, and the rest of Asia is in the green. Today, they were in the green, and the rest of Asia was in the red. How do we reconcile what's happening at the moment, understanding that the picture looks very different if you're looking at Asian markets versus European markets versus our own markets? How do you kind of make sense of what sentiment looks like at the moment?
Absolutely. I think generally sentiment looks good because we see slowing inflation and we see following the slowing inflation a general consensus of rate cutting. Yes, at different paces, but we do see that. In China, we are seeing government stimulus, government economic stimulus, and we see the hopes of continued stimulus. But we do have that elephant in the room on the Ukraine border. And that seems to keep on escalating. And then on the other side, although they have reached a ceasefire between Lebanon and Israel today, the bigger Israel geopolitical pressure is still very much present. So we see Russia drastically escalating towards Ukraine with massive bombing strikes on that side. And then I think we're far from over in the Middle East. So the European market has got a very steady threat of war right around them. In the US and in the Far East, we see markets performing a little bit better because I think they're further away from the problem area. And then lastly, if we bring it back home, we've been in a muted market for more than a decade. And now we see electricity reliability, we see infrastructure developments pulling through, we see the GNU holding, we see the rand strengthening in some of our trading days over the last month below 18 rand. And we see our rate cuts coming through as planned. We see the governor not following on a day-to-day basis the Americans' rate of cut, which we love. We think it's very responsible. I think things are looking good locally. Absolutely.
I had a small chuckle as you said that, Nellis, that the GNU is holding together. And in my head, I'm thinking, I wonder what glue they're using because it really has survived some really tough times. I want to look at some local things that have been in the news, especially SENS announcements that we got today. We got NAMPAC results today. The market less than impressed, and that's putting it mildly. I mean, the share price down quite a bit. Is anyone even still looking at paper companies?
I think the paper space is quite interesting. We see NAMPAC with a massive turnaround. I mean, 133% rise in trading profit and a 7% revenue increase. So that's very resilient numbers. And then we see the upcoming Novus Mustek merger, which is also moving kind of in the same space for Novus. But no, Jimmy, I think paper companies as a general is falling out of favor because we get hammered by tech and we see new market entrants like a We Buy Cars, for example, which was a very exciting listing this year. I think NAMPAC has become boring.
That's quite interesting. Speaking of exciting listings, I don't know if this is a listing per se, but it looks as though the Anglo-American stable is still on that path of unbundling and unlocking value within the business. Another accelerated book build for the Amplats business. What's been happening there? I think the last one, if I remember correctly, was just north of 5% that was sold into the market. It seemed like it was a bit of a teaser or a tester as to what could potentially be put into the market in future. What's been announced today?
Absolutely. So today, selling an additional 16 million shares in Amplats. So that's a massive number as part of their broader strategy, as you so rightly say, to unbundle their platinum assets. It aligns with the company's goal of reducing debt and streamlining. We get the feeling that they are prepping for something big.
Is that something big, another offer from BHP? Because I know there's that mandatory waiting period, and obviously BHP, when you're sitting there with a balance sheet that is the size of BHP's, you can afford to wait it out and come back and say, well,
of course,
we'll put in an offer later.
Yeah, we'll check in later. We're just waiting for the credit card to load back up.
Yeah.
So absolutely, that's definitely a possibility in the near future. I think we are due to see a lot more merger and acquisition action over the next 24 to 36 months as the global economy finally recovers after the whole COVID massive spike in inflation, massive spike in interest rates, and now it's kind of normalizing again. And one of the first leading indicators would be companies streamlining their balance sheets for a possible merger or acquisition in the near future.
I think you and I are going to sit down, Nellis, before the end of the year and decide on what the key areas might look like next year for M&A activity. There certainly has been an uptick in the interest from that perspective, especially with guys that have strong balance sheets. But we'll have to leave this conversation there for now. Thank you so much, Nellis, for the time and for the insights. Nellis Brink, who is wealth manager at PSG Wealth, joining me to take a look at what's been moving the markets today, some SENS announcements, as well as a lot of US data that's come out.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As local and international tourists get ready to flock to popular destinations like Cape Town and Durban this holiday season, South Africa's hospitality sector seems set for a resurgence. But despite this enthusiasm, many hospitality shares are still trading well below their pre-pandemic prices. Tune in to the SAFM Market Update this evening at 6:45 as Varshan Maharaj, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray, explains why undervalued hospitality companies offer a long-term growth opportunity for patient investors. Brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As I mentioned at the start of the show, there is a group of very, very smart people at an institution called Oxford Economics. They've put together a report on the future economic impact of South African Airways. SAA has recently come out of business rescue. They've gotten things to look a lot better than what they did before, albeit a smaller SAA, but a profitable SAA, it seems. And off the back of that, there was a report that was put together by Oxford Economics around what SAA could potentially add in terms of impact to many sectors, to the tourism sector, to the aviation sector, and to their bottom line as well. And that includes, obviously, things like tax contributions and the like there. I'm joined on the line by an economist at Oxford Economics, Marita Jacobs, to take a look at this. She's actually the senior econometrician at the Oxford Economics Africa team to take a look at this report and see if we can make sense of it. Marita, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Before we get into the conversation, what is an econometrician?
I was expecting that question. So an econometrician, if I can put it in very simple terms, is someone that specializes in economic modeling.
Okay. Specializes in economic modeling, not an electrician for economics. Okay, got it.
Unfortunately, no.
Let's look at this report. It's quite an interesting report because looking at the SOEs is no small task, especially understanding that it's a very different landscape to what other listed companies or even private companies might look like. There's a lot more elements that go into that. Let's start with the methodology of what you were looking for here and what you were looking at when this report was being compiled.
Yes. So our findings are largely based on SAA's current most recent financial results for the 2023-24 year, as well as their own projections for their revenues going up to 29-30, as well as their expectations for cargo, passengers, and flight schedules. So that was sort of the base of what we had to work with. And then we use what we call an input-output model, and that shows us how spending, or it's a structure of the economy, showing how different sectors are connected. So through that model, we can see how, you know, the what SAA spends and what they do, how that filters through the economy. And then on top of that, we know that SAA, you know, facilitates international trade and the tourist come to South Africa and they at restaurants and shops and so forth, who also have a supply chain and pay wages. So that also generates additional GDP, employment and tax revenues. And then we also looked at international trade that SAA facilitates and the impact that that has on wholesalers and those in the logistics industry that are involved in moving goods between producers and consumers. And all of that adding up gives us SAA's potential future economic impact.
So definitely looking across the entire value chain of where SAA would have some form of influence or potential involvement, whether it's direct impact, indirect impact, something called induced impact. And we're going to look, I want to look into those final components in a bit more detail. When we talk about the core economic impact, what does that mean and what does that look like for SAA in terms of where they currently are and where we expect them to be?
Yes, so the core impact is SAA's operation, its supply chain, and the wages that they pay. So that's the core impact. And we estimate that the value of that to the South African economy in 23-24 was 7.1 billion rand. So as SAA is going to expand their flight routes to various destinations, we expect that that impact is going to grow to 22.6 billion by 29-30, and that's going to sustain an additional 48,900 jobs in the South African economy.
Marita, when we look at the state of SAA now, you mentioned, of course, that we anticipate that they will expand, but this is obviously a very different SAA to the one that emerged from business rescue in 2021. It's got less fleet, less airplanes in its fleet. It's got less routes. What are some of the assumptions that you've made in looking at this report? I mean, understanding that, of course, variables like a government of national unity or variables like SAA's debt are things that you can only forecast up to a point. What are some of the assumptions you guys have made up to this point when compiling this report?
So as I mentioned, our study largely used SAA's own projections in terms of their expected potential revenue going into the future based on the additional flight routes that they are planning to, for example, the EU, China, or America. And so they have estimated the number of passengers that they could accommodate on those flights, as well as the cargo that they can likely ship on those flights. So that forms sort of the basis of our analysis.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at the impact in the broader sense, so impact in terms of the tourism impact from SAA's perspective, the impact on the aviation sector, we know that that sector's been going through a lot of changes. What can be said around the involvement or the role that SAA is going to play in the tourism space in the next 5 years, but also in getting a lot more travel into South Africa and out of South Africa?
Yes. So one thing that we can see from our tourism impact is that it is definitely going to grow. And the reason for this is SAA's planned expansion to areas where South Africa has strong tourist markets, such as the EU. And those markets typically also have a higher average spend than tourists from other perhaps regional markets. So as SAA expands into these more international areas which attract a lot of tourists for South Africa, we can see that tourism component growing substantially.
Marita, you had on the report that at the moment it looks as though there's about 25,000 jobs that are supported by the SAA business, and you forecast that in 5 years or so this will be around 86,700 jobs. How realistic is that given the current employment situation in South Africa? Are those skilled jobs? Are those across the entire value chain, or is that specifically sort of more direct and core impact jobs created by SAA?
No, so that is across the entire value chain. So it includes people that will be directly employed through SAA's activities and its supply chain, but also hospitality jobs as a range of skill levels, those in the wholesale sector, transport. So that 86,700 jobs that will be supported in the future is across the whole spectrum and across a whole range of sectors that have a variety of skill levels.
And of course, with all of these increases, there's an expected increase in contributions towards fiscal revenues and taxes. What does that look like?
Yes. So our current 23-24 estimates show that SAA contributes 1.5 billion rand to tax revenue, and that's again across the entire spectrum of impacts that we looked at. And we're expecting that to grow to roughly 6.4 billion rand by 2029-30.
Well, certainly some interesting insights, and anyone out there that still has that 3.1 billion rand lying around to pump into something that wants to invest into SAA, this might be a useful report to take a look at the potential future impact that SAA will have on the South African economy. We'll leave the conversation there, Marita. Thanks so much for taking the time. That's Marita Jacobs, who is a senior econometrician at Oxford Economics Africa, on the report they've compiled regarding the future of South African Airways.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
An IT security company based in Cape Town called Identify has come up with a very interesting thought piece around the dangers associated with business identity theft. Now, when we think about identity theft, the first thing that jumps to mind is someone stealing your ID, stealing your banking information, your personal information. But seldom do we think about it from a business perspective. And I imagine that has some different sets of implications. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Strategy Officer at Identify. That is Lance Fanaroff, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Lance. Thanks so much for taking the time. What is business identity theft, and how does that differ from personal identity theft?
Well, a business identity theft is actually just the business's customers and clients. So businesses put in solutions whereby they like biometrically authenticate the customers, like you look at the banking industry, that come into their systems essentially. So it's actually, it isn't really business identity theft. It's really the customers of businesses, whether it be telcos or banks, that steal identities or commit identity fraud and use that to commit malicious financial crimes against the respective companies.
Lance, we've seen these things happen. We've seen where hackers of late have gone in and perpetrated cyber attacks on large organizations, including banks, and have obtained client information and sensitive information that would ordinarily be protected by things like the POPI Act, but now are at, or the information is now being used for ransom purposes and for other malicious activities. What are some of the industries that are most affected by this from a business perspective, if there are any specific industries, or is it just down to a security thing to say it's a specific type of security hack and anyone that's got that kind of security infrastructure is susceptible?
Yeah, no, so I don't think it's a specific security hack. I think that whether it's via technology or it's via these consortiums or syndicates that actually target certain businesses, and they look for weaknesses or vulnerabilities to get into those banks and or those telcos or those businesses, and how they do that is they target whether it's the respective businesses' employees or their customers, and via identity theft or identity fraud are able to sometimes penetrate into those banks or those telcos or those businesses. But I think financial institutions in general and businesses in general are becoming a lot more astute and investing, I think, a lot more. And I think it's a continual, obviously, cat and mouse game, but investing a lot more into preventing and protecting their clients' data from a poppy perspective. In fact, I'd say that's one of the most important things in institutions today to be able to protect the private data of their customers or their clients.
Speaking of protecting the private data of customers and clients, you put together quite a unique index, the first ever identity index that we've seen in South Africa. And I found it quite surprising that only, I think it was about 24.5% of those respondents that you had surveyed felt safe with their current security measures. Why is that?
Yes, I think it's such an ever-changing landscape. And I think that especially with AI and synthetic identity theft, where they're stealing real and fabricated identities to try and penetrate companies, it's a industry or it's a challenge for most companies today. So what we did, we partnered with Arthur Goldsack from Worldwide Works. And he did a survey of over 200 companies of all different levels to try and gauge where they were at from a practice perspective, from a preparedness perspective, and from a concern perspective, and see where they're at from being able to protect their clients and themselves from identity theft and identity fraud.
Lance,
so it is something, yeah.
Sorry, Lance, when we look at identity fraud and identity theft, a lot of it comes down to identity verification and identity verification solutions. Now, I'm thinking about things like biometrics, passwords, anything that really authenticates that you are who you say you are. With the growing advancement in artificial intelligence, where I can now take a photo of myself, upload it into an AI software, and have it generate a video of me with audio of me that sounds like me, how on earth am I going to stay safe?
Yes, so it's a very good question, and that's why technologies today that do proof of liveness. So most important is proof of biometric liveness. So I want to, or the business wants to prove that firstly you're a live person, and while they're proving that you're a live person, they're taking a selfie of you, and then they're comparing that selfie to the selfie or the facial image biometrically to the Department of Home Affairs. So proof of biometric liveness is a critical step, because you're confirming that it's that person at that very time that's actually performing the transaction or trying to get into the system using their biometric identity. So proof of liveness is critical, especially in the digital world. And we've seen how the digital world, especially since COVID, is growing exponentially and isn't going to stop. And it's across all different levels.
Mm.
So ensuring someone's alive is obviously essential.
Yeah. Lance, is there a way to do this in a more convenient manner? I'm just playing a bit of devil's advocate here, thinking if I'm out with a bunch of friends, there's a low lighting kind of environment that I'm in, I now need to take a selfie to get into my banking app. And obviously, if I'm really pedantic about my security, it's something I'm willing to do. But it just seems like that is a method that at some point could become inconvenient. It is, of course, the most secure method, because only you really look like you, unless someone has a very good plastic surgeon out there. How do you streamline processes like this and make it more efficient, or maybe look at things like fingerprints that also monitor a heart rate to get a pulse, or is that kind of technology out there?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, what we do, for example, is we do proof of liveness, proof of biometric liveness. And what happens is it's a rays of different colored lights that reflect off an individual's face in a certain sequence, and each time that sequence changes. And so that process happens, and while we do that, we're taking a selfie of the individual, and this is all via their mobile phone, any mobile phone. So it doesn't matter if Android, iOS, whatever level of hardware device it is. And that whole process in terms of proof of liveness, taking the selfie and comparing it to a biometric hash on record is literally 2 seconds. I'm saying end to end. So in terms of being convenient for customers or clients or people wanting to protect their own identity, I mean, these days the technology is there, and I think what you're going to see happening is organizations are going to start replacing OTP with this proof of liveness biometric onboarding, because it's the only, I think it was the safest or the strongest form of authentication and verification. So I think you're going to see something like this on the rise in a very big way.
The world is ever changing, and so is technology, but I imagine so are the criminals. So we'll see how this all plays out. Hopefully we get ahead of it and we can implement these safety measures. Thanks so much, Lance, for the insights and for the time. Lance Fanaroff, who is the Chief Strategy Officer at Identify, joining us to take a look at the rise in artificial intelligence-based fraud and how to protect yourself.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This segment is brought to you by Alan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing, Alan Gray is an authorized financial services provider. So we took a look at the impact that, or the potential future impact that SAA could have on the South African economy. We're going to take a look at the thoughts of a rather seasoned portfolio manager, we've spoken to him on the show before, Varshan Maharaj from Alan Gray, who believes that the tourism sector and the hospitality sector has been under a lot more pressure than necessary over the last little bit of time, and there might be a little bit of value there. He joins me now on the line to take a look at this and see if we can understand it a little bit better. Good evening, Varshan. Lovely to catch up with you again. I happen to agree with you. I'll say that right off the bat. I think there are certain stocks on the JSE in the hospitality sector that have been under a lot of pressure. But let's start by taking a look at the hospitality sector's performance sort of pre-pandemic, around up to 2019, and then during the pandemic and then post-pandemic. Has the sector fully recovered from what was a very, very long 21 days?
Good evening, Jimmy. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you once more. I appreciate it. And that's a great question. So maybe from a high level, when we consider the hospitality sector and hotels in particular, it's a very capex heavy industry and it's very cyclical as well. So we as investors need to take a view on where are we in the cycle. And that's really driven by when supply enters and leaves the market. And what I mean by that is when new hotels are built. So generally what we see is when new hotels are built, you see that occupancy rates go down and room rates go down as well. So in South Africa, post-1994, up until the 2010 FIFA World Cup, we enjoyed a period of strong economic growth. Occupancies were going up and hotels generally did quite well. And with the 2010 World Cup, we had a lot of new supply being added to the market, and that had the effect of occupancies going down and room rates going down as well. And subsequent to that, as demand grew to fill up that supply, occupancies and room rates ticked up as well as profits. And then with the COVID pandemic, hotels were put under severe restrictions and occupancies and room rates completely collapsed. And since then, we have seen quite a nice recovery. And due to the stress that hotels were in during the COVID period, there weren't many people who were willing to build new hotels. So we currently find ourselves in that upswing where we have occupancies rising as well as room rates. And to build a hotel generally takes 2 years or more. So at the moment, we don't see much new supply coming on the market in the next year or two. So we would expect those good profits to persist for a few years to come.
Vashon, you mentioned the new hotels, and I want to look at something else that I've noticed come out of the pandemic, a new kind of trend in the hotel space, where typically you would have an international hotel brand come into South Africa, build the new hotel and run it and everything. I've seen one or two deals where an international brand comes in, buys the hotel, but then partners with a local partner, and the local partner manages certain aspects of the hotel because obviously they would have the local knowledge a lot better. How would that then affect the business case for looking at those hospitality kind of companies? For an investor out there saying, I want to get involved in these kinds of companies or these kinds of sectors, are you looking at guys that have their own existing hotel sort of chain? Are you looking at the smaller guys that might be at a different price point, or the guys that are entering into these management kind of partnerships?
That's a very astute observation, Jimmy. And then, as you point out, there are different business models in the sector. So on the JSE, the two big groups that are listed are Southern Sun and City Lodge. And those two companies own almost all of their hotels. And on the other end of the spectrum, we get companies, as you mentioned, such as Marriott and Hilton, who, as you mentioned, they get third-party hotel owners. So of all the hotels in the Marriott and Hilton group, they only own about 1% of those hotels. The other 99% are owned by third parties. And those hotel owners are able to use Marriott's booking systems, IT systems, and so on, in exchange for a fee that they pay to Marriott. So when we look at Marriott, we see that as a very capital-light business, a very rapidly growing business, and their operations are worldwide as opposed to a Southern Sun or a City Lodge who are concentrated in South Africa. So we do find value on both ends of the spectrum in hotel owners listed in South Africa, as well as these global brand-owning companies such as Hilton and Marriott.
That would make sense. I mean, I'm thinking about another international brand and the advantages that you have from international brands, where you're able to kind of say you understand the standards that you're buying into or investing into because you know what the other hotels might look like around the world. Vashon, I want to look at the component from a room rate and a booking perspective. I want to look at the component that is, or the area that is filled by agencies, booking agencies and all of that. The likes of Airbnb or another conversation for another day, but they obviously play a role in how I access these rooms, how I reserve these rooms, and whether I pay a premium because I'm booking through an agency, or whether I get a room at a time where a hotel is available or unavailable. Is it safe to say that we can't just completely ignore these agencies now?
Sure, that's also another great point. So with online travel agents such as Booking.com, we find that in certain markets where they represent a very large portion of the hotel supply, they can put room rates under pressure. When we look at our own South African market, online travel agents such as Booking.com, in a group as Southern Sun, for example, they probably make up about 13 or 14% of the room bookings. And if we look at Southern Sun's total bookings, about 50% come directly to the group via their loyalty program and their website and so on. So Booking.com and other travel agents do perform a very valuable service. They act as a platform business. They connect the very fragmented guest side of the market to the very fragmented hotel owner side of the market. So we think that the market is big enough where companies such as Marriott and Hilton can continue to consolidate one part of the market, and Booking.com can continue to consolidate a different pool of hotel owners. And we see very bright prospects for both those groups of companies going forward.
Vashon, how do those prospects line up with the hospitality market? Because unlike other sectors, unlike consumer companies like ShopRite, where consumers are always having consistent demand, markets like the hospitality and tourism sector are very, very cyclical in nature. When you are then looking to invest in these kinds of sectors, do you then say, I want to invest at a particular time in the cycle? Or do you then say, I'll invest after I see results, after I see what performance looks like? How do you measure the cyclicality of hospitality shares? And what does that mean for an investor looking at that market?
Sure, that's another great question. So I'll separate it into two groups. First, for the hotel owners, and secondly, for the brand owners, because there are different considerations. So for the hotel owners themselves, one would need to look at where are you in the cycle in terms of new supply coming to the market. So as I mentioned earlier, for the South African hotel owners, I think we're currently in that upswing phase where profits are increasing and new supply hasn't yet come into the market in a material way. When it comes to brand owners, they are sort of growing their network where they're getting new hotels to join their ecosystem over time. So even if the hotel market as a total is growing at low single digits percent per annum, these businesses are able to grow at a much faster rate by getting more independent hotel owners to join their ecosystem. So something like a Marriott has a very sort of formulaic structure to grow their business, where they increase their number of rooms by mid-single digits per annum, and then they increase the rates that they charge or the revenue from those rooms by low single digits per annum. And they also buy back shares, and they have an aspect of operating leverage to their business. So when we add up those different factors, we find that a Marriott and a Hilton have been able to grow their earnings per share in dollars at more than 10% per annum for a long period of time. And we think they have a long runway to continue doing that for years to come.
The business case that exists for hospitality sector stocks in South Africa, it certainly is an interesting one. We'll leave the conversation there, Varshan. Thanks so much for the time. As always, Varshan Maharaj, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray. The segment was brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Wednesday, it's Executive Lounge time, and we're getting to know another South African executive a little bit better beyond what it is that they do. This week's executive is the CEO of the listed company Lesaka Technologies. I'm, of course, referring to Lincoln Mali. We often catch up with him when we look at Lesaka results, but this time around, we're taking a look at his life beyond running a JSE-listed firm. He joins me now on the line to take a look at what his day-to-day looks like and what he gets up to when he's not working so hard. Good evening, Lincoln. Thanks so much for taking the time. How did you get into a business like Lesaka and into a position like the CEO of a listed firm?
I still have to ask our shareholders how that went. All that happened was I received a call from a headhunter, and I'd been with the Standard Bank Group for 20 years, and I'd never gone to coffee or anything with anybody because my blood was blue. And then out of the blue, there was a conversation for me to go and engage with people from the then NetOne. Obviously, my first response was to run a mile until I had a conversation with a guy called Ali Mazandarani, who painted a picture to me of a future from a dark place where the company was at to a future that he was describing. And I think in that 90 minutes, I was sold. And all I wanted was to go and be part of change, because they were focused on disruption, financial inclusion, digital transformation, and a turnaround of a business. And I think all of those things kind of really, really resonated with me.
Mm. Lincoln, what would you say was the most daunting thing about making that transition? I mean, having been at the Blue Bank for as long as you had been at, I'm sure you would have built up quite a rich network of relationships, and leaving a place like that can't be easy after having given so much of your time to it. How do you then make the move and the transition? What conversations are you having with the family? What goes through your mind at that moment?
I think probably the two biggest things was, one, what would I say to the hundreds and hundreds of people that over the 20 years I'd persuaded to stay at Standard Bank? And that was something that was very difficult for me, because it was not about Standard Bank. It was about where I wanted to go and where and what the future held. And I guess that was the first thing I was saying to myself. Would I be able to explain to people why I was leaving and why it made sense to me? The second one had to do with trying to deal with the magnitude of the challenge that the then NetOne faced, and whether was I the right person to kind of be able to deal with that. But when I saw who was on the board, I realized that all of these very seasoned executives had given their own reputations to this because they believed in it, and therefore I could be part of a team like that.
Lincoln, I get the sense that for you, making an impact is important, and I bring that up because I want to talk about the foundation. Not many people know that you have a foundation that you are actively involved in. It's not merely a foundation that is called the Lincoln Mallee Foundation that doesn't see its benefactor and founder ever, but you do annual events. Sometimes you do more than one event in a year if time allows for that. Take me through the reasoning behind saying, I'm making an impact in life, but I need to do more.
Yeah, to me, my dad had always taught me about the importance of contributing to community and contributing to society. And I'd done that in, call it a haphazard way, for a while. And then I had an opportunity to go to Boston to school there. And when I came back, what inspired me was a lecture by the late Professor Clay Christensen, whose theme was, how will you measure your life? And I decided to be more deliberate in my activities on contributing to society. And then Giacomo Ray, who was then our CEO at Standard Bank, decided to put I think it was 5 or 10% of his salary towards education. So I decided there and then to do something similar, where I would put time and money towards things that I believe in. And so I've been doing that probably for 15 years. And then 3 years ago, when I launched my book, I started this foundation and consolidated all of the activities that I was doing into this foundation. And now we have a thriving movement, if you want. One is on youth development, where we have an annual youth summit that we do with the Henley Business School, where we take 250 of the brightest minds in South Africa and link them up with top CEOs, and they spend a day together in masterclasses. Another one is a rugby tournament in honor of my father, Mzwanele Mali, that's been running for the last 10 years, where we focus on township rugby, because township rugby had started to die in the Eastern Cape. And there's a rich history there of about 130 years where my father's club was formed, when my father's club was formed. So this year we had 24 schools and about 528 boys that participated. And it culminated to a trip overseas at the invitation of Seven Oaks Rugby Football Club in Kent in the UK. We also have a cricket tournament that I've done over the last 11 years in honor of my uncle, Ray Mali, which is focused on rural cricket clubs. And then we've got mentorship and speaking engagements with young people. So all of these things are meant to really help us to be midwives to Africa's rebirth by developing the next layer of leaders, because there were people that believed in me when my future looked bleak. And I want to do similar with other young people and give them an opportunity to shine.
That's quite a remarkable story and a remarkable reason behind building a foundation like the one that you have. Lincoln, you mentioned Boston earlier. Where's your favorite travel destination if you look back to all of the places you've been to in the world, or perhaps even one you haven't been to yet?
My wife will kill me for this, but I would say for business, it would be Nigeria. It's an incredible, incredible environment. Nigeria has 36 provinces or states. I've had the blessing to travel to 28 of those states. and see the country in action. And believe me, if I had an opportunity to go to Nigeria now, I would go again. The other one is China. I think there's a fascinating society there, business environment, and there's a lot that I think can be discovered there. And for me, the travel in South Africa is probably my favorite. I really, really love traveling within the country. I've seen the world, but there's no place like home. So any place where there's one of our wonderful South African beaches is an opportunity for me to become a do-nothing king and just sit there with a good book or writing or just watching the waves. That's my my place of travel and what I enjoy the most.
Lincoln, what about the food? Which of these countries has the best cuisine?
I would say I have enjoyed French cuisine. I must say I don't go there as often. And so when we do have an opportunity, my wife and I do enjoy just those lovely restaurants where you just sit outside, very close, very intimate with very, very good chefs and sometimes with very good views. You know, so that's really, really, really what I enjoy.
Mm. Lincoln, when you're on that beach where you've got that beach view that you enjoy so much, what are you reading?
I'm always likely to be reading some biography or some leadership book or some sports book. And really, it's about trying to become a better person, trying to improve myself as a person, as a leader, trying to improve myself as a husband, as a father. So I'm always fascinated by books like that. I'm also fascinated by books about change in society and change in the digital world, technology and what technology can do for society, not technology for technologies. So those are the kinds of books I like reading. If I'm not doing that, then I'm watching TV because I'm also a very, I'm a TV nut as well.
Are you binge watching any particular series at the moment? Are you particularly focused on something?
I have been watching probably for the 15th time the Narcos series.
That's a quality series.
So those are the things that I'm able sometimes to do when I just come back from a long, 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 call it day and evening at Lusaka. I don't think I should call it a day. Just things that should take your mind away. So I've just been watching, to my wife's annoyance, maybe for the 15th time, the Narcos or El Chapo and any of those kinds of things. Just to take your mind away from serious matters.
Well, I'll certainly send you a list of my series that I recommend. There's a couple that I think you would get along with there. Lincoln, before we wrap things up, you mentioned a little earlier that you have been privileged and blessed to have had people in your life that have been there for you when no one else was and that have believed in you and no one else would. What would you say is the one piece of advice that you hold on to that was shared with you in your time?
I think my dad's thing about treating everybody the same, regardless of race, color, religion, gender, has stood me very well. The second one is around getting feedback from the people around you. My wife is, the person who gives me regular feedback, and my kids, solicited or unsolicited. And I think those keep you grounded. They keep you grounded and you get a sense. And then the third one is around lifelong learning, that I'm always learning. And I learned a lot of that from Sim Chabalala that I worked with for 20 years. Sim is always reading, always learning. And even things he doesn't understand, he'll test himself and challenge himself. So even in this role, if anybody would have said to me I would occupy a CEO role, for an NASDAQ or JSE listed company, I would have said, they're confused.
Lifelong learning and a propensity for feedback. We'll leave the conversation there because it has gone 7 o'clock. Thank you so much, Lincoln, for the time and for the insights. That was Lincoln Miley, CEO at Lesaka, joining us for our Executive Lounge. And as I said, that it has gone 7 o'clock. So Greg Kos is standing by for the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.